This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we call our show Main Street because our microphones create one all across North Dakota this time of day. It's sort of a virtual Main Street, if you will. Those real ones that are vital centers of our communities are where we greet each other, it's, you know, share our news and opinions, talk about what's on our minds. And, of course, we're talking about chocolate these days because we're in our short and sweet fundraising drive for Prairie Public. And Ashley Thornburg and I are here in studio, and we've got Christina Demick. She's an author, and she joins us by phone from Utah. We're going to talk about chocolate.
Christina, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You are the author of several books, several cookbooks, and the one we are most interested in is the Chocolate Lovers Cookbook. What made you want to write this one, besides the fact that chocolate is amazing?
Well, I grew up in a family that loved chocolate, and as I was thinking back on, you know, what I wanted to have one for my kids to look at when I'm gone and say, oh, this mom did this. And then two, for me to share with friends and family and readers and home cooks and professional cooks and anybody that loves chocolate, this was the book that came to mind. I wanted to put this out there sort of as a heritage even for my kids, because when I was growing up, chocolate was a part of life.
And what's your take on chocolate? What are you bringing to this particular book?
It's the lifelong love and recipes that I've gathered from my family. You'll find in there recipes from my mom. I think I put five of her recipes in the book. My grandmothers on both sides of the family, they're tried and true recipes. They come out every single time. They're, you know, and they're things that you can serve your family or you can dress up and serve guests. And so it's a nice way. It's chocolate in the home. It's not something that's too fancy to do, but it looks really fancy.
Chocolate can sometimes even be a little bit temperamental, especially as you start working with the higher-end chocolates. Did you learn anything that really surprised you during this process?
During the process of writing the book?
Yeah.
Not as much, because where I learned, my family every year, the day after Thanksgiving, the women in our family would gather, and we would dip chocolates. And I learned to temper chocolate at my aunt's elbow as she was dipping and tempering. And I was 8 years old when I was able to dip my first chocolate. Before that, I was just an errand girl, and I'd run for things. But, yeah, at eight, I was trusted enough to dip my first batch, and it wasn't pretty. And we ended up rolling all of them in nuts to hide what I'd done. For me, the process was, I guess the fun thing I learned in it is that chocolate is a language a lot of people speak.
That's for sure.
When you're talking about chocolate, there are a lot of things in common with other people, and that, I think, is what's great about it, is it can bring people together.
Not all chocolate is the same. What are the distinctions we should be aware of?
One of them is how much cacao is in chocolate. For example, you know, milk chocolate has milk in it, but it also has a very low amount of cacao in it. It's usually at least 10%, probably not much more. And so it's going to be really, really sweet. Whereas if you go into like a dark chocolate, it has more between 50 and 80% cacao. And so you're going to get that a little bit more bitter taste to it, and you're going to want to add your own sweeteners.
How have your tastes for chocolate changed over the years, or have you always preferred either milk or dark?
No, when I was little, I wanted all the sweet stuff. Mm-hmm. But as I've grown, probably in the last 5 years, I've leaned more towards semi-sweets and darks. And I don't know if that's a maturing of the palate or if it's just an exploration of the different flavors.
Christina Demick is the author of Chocolate Lover's Cookbook, and of course we're talking about chocolate because it's the theme of the day with our short and sweet fundraiser. There's chocolate for eating, just unwrap the bar and start chomping away, and there's chocolate for cooking. What are the distinctions there?
Chocolate for eating is going to be sweetened. It's going to have more sugars in it than cooking chocolate does. Cooking chocolate has zero amount of sweeteners in it. And so you're going to need to add sugar or honey, or if you prefer stevia, something that's going to bring out a little bit of the deeper flavors in the chocolate by contrasting it with the sugars.
What do you look for when you shop for chocolate?
It may sound funny, but one of the first things I do is smell the chocolate.
How do you do that?
through the package. Chocolate isn't going to hide. Good chocolate won't hide, I should say. The cheap chocolate probably won't have much of a smell, but if it's good chocolate, you're going to be able to tell right through that package that it's good. So, and one of the things that's really interesting is that with the different cacao beans, they have different flavorings. The one that we're most used to in America has kind of a hazelnut undertone to it, and this is determined by the DNA of the cacao bean. It's not, you know, I have orchards and things around me, and I see the bees pollinating, and I know that those bees are changing, giving a little bit more flavor to certain peaches and apples and things, and then they go back and they take that into their honey, but that's not how it works with cacao beans. It's all about the DNA. And I've even found some that have a green olive undertone to them.
Whoa.
You wouldn't get unless you really smelled and took time to understand that. And so if you're using the chocolate with berries and things, you'd want a chocolate that has a berry undertone to it.
Well, let's take this up a level. We've talked about what you look for when you're shopping for chocolate. Now, when you are getting it home and you are actually tasting, there is a method, there is a ritual to tasting chocolate.
Yes. And for, you know, if I trust the chocolate source, I won't do it every time. But for the newer ones, the first thing that you do is you break the chocolate and you smell it to get that really deep, just right after you break it, and you put it right up next to your nose so that that's the only thing you're smelling. You're not getting any of the other scents from your kitchen in there. And then you begin to rub it between your thumb and your fingers so that it melts, and then you can smell it again. And this will release aromas that you didn't notice the first time around.
And I won't forget to lick my fingers. You're talking about a block of chocolate here, though, aren't you?
Yes, for sure.
And not chocolate chips. So what are some tips for handling a block of chocolate? That's something I don't usually use.
You're going to want to keep it in a cool, dry place. Don't put it in your freezer. That was for a couple of years, that was the fad, was keep your chocolate in the freezer. But what this does is it freezes. If there's wax in your chocolate, it's going to bring that wax to the surface. And it can also separate the milk from the chocolate, and then you get what's called bloomed chocolate. And you can see it because there's a white coating around the top.
Yeah, I've seen that before. Does that mean the chocolate's gone bad?
Chocolate chips can be remelted because it's the wax that's in them most likely that's come out. And so when you melt it, the wax will recombine with the chocolate, and they'll be okay.
And why is the wax in the chocolate?
It's to help it keep its shape.
Okay.
Yeah.
A chocolate kiss, I guess, huh?
Yeah, so they look like chocolate chips instead of just little marbles of chocolate. So keep it in a cool, dry place. Keep it wrapped. Don't just set it out or expose it to, you know, the different temperatures throughout the day. And then when you go to use it, break off what you're going to use and then put the rest back. Don't manhandle the whole block every time you try and use it.
Is there an element to tasting chocolate that would be sort of similar to a wine tasting? You want to know how it feels in your mouth, and is there a way to move it around your mouth to get that?
Yeah, so you can place the chocolate on your tongue and put it towards the roof of your mouth and hold it there for 15 seconds.
Torture.
I know, it is torture. Because you're so close to being able to eat the chocolate, and yet you have to hold. And this is going to allow the chocolate to soften and melt so that you can. And then what I do is I swirl my tongue around and make sure every part of my tongue gets a little bit of chocolate on it, because different parts of your tongue taste different things. And so if there's a little bit of salt in there, you're going to taste that on the tip of your tongue. So you swirl your tongue around, get the chocolate all over it, and then you can finally chew what's left. Usually I have kind of a big piece in there, so I get a good chance to eat. But and then it is like a wine tasting, because you're going to suck in air through your mouth and over the top of the back of your throat. And you'll be shocked at the different tastes and flavors that come up. It's kind of amazing to see that there is these different undertones that we just take for granted.
And in your cooking, do these different flavor notes apply to different kinds of chocolate treats?
They can. I try if I'm doing a pie or a cake, something that's, you know, one pan kind of a deal. I try for the sweeter undertones. If I'm doing something a little more fancy, I might pick something with the hazelnut or even a little bit bitter, especially if it's just a garnish. A little bit of the bitterness can make whatever is sweet in your cake or brownie or whatever stand out even more.
What's a reasonable price to pay for really, you know, good chocolate, cooking chocolate in this case?
Chocolate chips can be anywhere between $3 to $5 for a bag of good, high quality chocolate chips, just a 12-ounce bag. If you're looking for something a little fancier, when we dip our chocolates, the big blocks of chocolate we buy are usually about $45 for 10 pounds.
So $4.50 a pound.
Mm-hmm.
And what's a 10-pound block of chocolate look like? I mean, how big is that?
It's about twice the size of your average cutting board.
Wow.
So you're making a lot of chocolate here.
We are. We do probably 150 pounds a year.
And is this
on that one day?
This is for family consumption? Are you selling these? That's a lot.
It is. And so because it was all the women in the family, there was my mom and her two sisters, and then I was the only granddaughter for several years, and then my grandmother. So we would divide them up between the four families, and then they'd give them away as neighbor gifts. They'd give them away for at work as gifts, or family, definitely family parties throughout the holidays. We had a candy dish out, which was my favorite part of the whole party.
Well, if I've got a 10-pound block of chocolate, what kinds of kitchen tools should I have at hand?
You're going to want to get a butcher's knife, a really big, thick, nice butcher's knife, and placing it on a wooden cutting board, placing the chocolate on a wooden cutting board, and then using the point of the knife to break off some pieces or using the side of it to shave off pieces. And it's really a laborious process. It's not my favorite part of dipping chocolate, getting the big chunks into smaller chunks that we can then melt. But it has to be done.
I read in your book, The Chocolate Lover's Cookbook, kind of a pro tip here, cut the corners of the block. Don't try to cut the whole width of the block.
Yeah, yeah. The blade is not long enough to go along that whole width, and it's awkward when you're trying to cut along a straight line. But if you cut the corners, then you can go really fast.
And the stuff can be pretty hard, actually.
Yes, very hard.
You've mentioned a few times about dipping chocolate, so we got to melt it. You know, I haven't tried that very much because it looks to me it's been a little bit daunting. How do you suggest that we temper or melt chocolate?
The best way to do it is over a double boiler. And so you have one pan that has water in it that you're bringing to a warm temperature. You don't want it to boil. You don't want to do anything too fast with chocolate. Chocolate is all about moving slow, which is funny because we eat it so fast, right? But so you want to move slowly and maybe just get a little bit of steam coming out. When I do it, I test the water. If it feels warm, then it's probably too warm. You want it right about what your body temperature would be. And if you think about holding a block of chocolate in your hand and watching it melt, that's enough to help it melt. It just won't melt quickly. And then you put another pan inside that one and fill it with your chocolate. And you want to make sure that you keep your water and your chocolate separate, because if water gets in the chocolate, it will seize, which means that it becomes hard and crumbly and not even good to taste. It doesn't taste good at all. And you just have to throw it out and start all over. So keep the water separate from the chocolate. Keep the water about the same temperature as your fingers. And then just have a lot of patience.
So how long should it take?
When we're doing a batch of chocolate and we're doing large groups, it takes about an hour to get it to the point that we can use it for dipping.
Okay.
And then as the day goes by, we add more chunks as we're working So it's continually tempering as we're working, and we're not running out.
And what are you dipping?
Oh, we dip fondant, fudges, pinoche, nuts. Sometimes we do a cookie dough truffle. We do all sorts of truffles. Anything, pretty much anything we can get our hands on, we'll dip in chocolate.
Are there cardinal sins of working with chocolate?
There are. One of them's the water, keeping the water out. Another one that isn't really well known is that white chocolate, when you're melting white chocolate and you're thinning it, you don't use milk. You need to use an oil, because milk does to white chocolate what water does to regular chocolate. And
well, white chocolate isn't chocolate either, is it?
Right. It comes from a different part of the bean. So, yeah, you're going to want to use an oil to keep it smooth. Really, chocolate doesn't have a lot of rules. If you're working with it the way it likes, it'll behave.
Well, let's talk about some recipes here. You mentioned that you got these recipes from your mom and your grandma, so they're time-tested and they're mm-hmm. sort of foolproof and all that. Share a favorite one with us that's easy enough to share over the radio.
Okay, so my mom, these are Rolaine's chocolate chip cookies. They're found on page 62 in the cookbook. She made these all growing up. These were first day of school cookies, last day of school cookies, Wednesday cookies. These were the cookies. This was her cookie go-to recipe. And it's 3 eggs, 2 cups of sugar, 2 cups of brown sugar, 1 pound of melted butter, 2 teaspoons vanilla, 6 cups of flour, 1.5 teaspoons baking soda, 1.5 teaspoons of salt, 1.5 cups of oatmeal, which means you can eat them for breakfast because they count, and 4 cups of chocolate chips.
Wow.
Any kind. It
How big is this army you're making cookies yes. for here?
I know, right? But what she would do is she would bake a couple pans full for us to eat that day, and then she would put the rest in balls and put them in the freezer, and they would last up to 30 days in the freezer. And so it was great because we could come home from school and pull a couple of the balls out and stick them in the oven and have fresh cookies every day if we wanted.
Oh, that sounds good.
Fantastic.
We are visiting with Christina Dimick. She is the author of the Chocolate Lovers Cookbook. You know, Christina, cooks and chefs are so often communicating with the food. What are you saying to your friends and to your family when you cook for them?
I love that concept. What I feel like I'm saying is that I care enough about you that I spent my time thinking of you and baking for you.
Hmm. Well, you're not just the author of the Chocolate Lovers Cookbook and other cookbooks. You write romance novels too. It sounds like we're getting there.
Sweet romance, yes. Just like my chocolate, it's sweet. Yes, and I write under the name Christina Dimick, and I write also under the name, my grandmother's name, Lucy McConnell. She gave me one of the recipes for this Chocolate Lovers Cookbook. It's her recipe for nut balls, and she passed away a few years ago, and so as a tribute to her, I use her name as a pen name.
And for our listeners who are interested, Christina Dimick has a website, which is Christina Dimick. .wordpress.com. Dimick is spelled D-Y-M-O-C-K. And you are the author of the Chocolate Lovers Cookbook. And, of course, we're in our short and sweet fun drive for Prairie Public. So thank you for coming on with us today to talk about the sweetness of chocolate.
Thank you. This is wonderful.
Prairie Public stays on the air thanks to our members. What are members? They're the people who say, I listen, I love, I support. Now is the time to act. Donate online at prairiepublic.org or call 800-359-4145. You'll be glad you did because you can pat yourself on the back and say, I did it. I helped keep Prairie Public on the air. And we thank you. Donate online at prairiepublic.org or call 1-800-359-4145.
Right now, we're taking a moment out to talk about the fact that we are a public radio station. That's why we are able to bring you great programs like Main Street. And we could not do it at all without contributions from listeners like you. I'm Bill Thomas here with, of course, Doug Hamilton.
And it's great to have you with us, Bill. Our Main Street audience, of course, is keyed up to the fact, because we've told them more than once now that we're in our short and sweet membership drive, which just goes through midday Saturday, so we don't have a lot of time to tell people about our one box of handmade cocoa truffles from Nicole's Fine Pastry. They're about as good as they get, and that's a gift from us to you for your donation of a sustained membership of $10 a month for a year. That's $120 over the course of the year. That's not even a month's cable bill these days.
Ooh,
but,
no.
But it's an investment in what you're listening to. And if you're listening right now and you're not a member, well, this is your chance to make good on what you ought to be doing right now. Give us a call, 1-800-359-4145, or online at prairiepublic.org.
When you listen, you learn things here on Main Street. You learn things typically a lot about what's going on around our area, sometimes nationally and internationally as well. It's a daily conversation with interviews and reviews and all kinds of things about the arts and science and development and politics. And it's a great thing to have. And we could not have it without listener support from people like you. 1-800-359-4145. PrairiePublic.org.
When we were on the air earlier this morning, Bill, there was a pledge that came in, a very touching one, made in memory of Deanna Pearl, who was an avid NPR supporter and listened every day. And we thank those people for remembering the legacy of people who have now left us, but certainly were supporters while they were here. And we appreciate the fact that somebody was this thoughtful, making a pledge in memory of someone else.
Right. And let me mention some of the other people that have called in this afternoon. We haven't had a chance to talk about them on the air yet. Maxine Fagerlund, thank you so much, Maxine. We know her. She sometimes comes down and helps to answer the phones. Nicholas Vann from Bismarck, Gary Hildreth from Fargo, Tricia Halverson-Lunsky from Grand Forks. And these are people who said we could read their names. There were some other ones who said we couldn't, but that's fine if you want to be anonymous. And some of those people took one box of truffles. Notice one person took four boxes of truffles.
I saw that one, and the numbers I've been seeing are at $10 a month, one box of truffles, $15, two boxes of truffles, $20, three boxes of truffles. So
yeah,
thank
we had,
you for those.
Tim and Claudette Peterson called in this morning and took seven boxes of truffles. I know they passed them around to people that they want to express appreciation to.
Well, for those people who have had these cocoa truffles, and we have, they're memorable. They're worth considering as a Valentine's gift, and of course they will be delivered in the continental U.S. before Valentine's Day. So this is your opportunity to help Prairie Public and, you know, kind of work on your romantic life as well. Give us a call, 1-800-359-4145, or online at prairiepublic.org. We'll have more Main Street in a moment. Now the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Congressman Kevin Cramer says it was chaos this morning as the Amtrak train he and his wife Chris were passengers on struck a train at a crossing in Virginia.
We suddenly hit a bump real hard and the train stopped. Since we're in the last car, we were able to see what the cause of the bump was, and that was we ran into a garbage truck, and the garbage truck is laying on the side of the tracks. I'm looking at it right now. Garbage strewn everywhere. The truck is separated in half.
Cramer says the crash has shaken us to the core. The train was carrying Republican lawmakers to a policy retreat in West Virginia. Amtrak says no one on board the train was seriously injured. One person in the truck was killed. Senator John Hoeven was driving to the retreat, so he was not on the train. The Public Service Commission has approved the siting for a new 150-megawatt wind farm in Dickey County. The Foxtail Wind Farm siting was sought by NextEra Energy. That company plans to sell the site to Xcel Energy, which will build the wind farm. Commissioner Julie Fedorchak says the company worked with North Dakota Game and Fish and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to make sure there were no issues with wildlife. She says the company also worked with the tribes to address potential cultural concerns.
This has been kind of identified as a potential model for other projects moving forward.
Ann Fedorchak says based on the public hearing the PSC held in Ellendale, the project appears to have a lot of support in that area.
Nobody came forward and opposed this project or even spoke negatively about it from the community.
Xcel plans to use 75 turbines using 2 megawatts of power each. And the effort to end North Dakota's blue laws will go to the legislature instead of an initiated measure. Fargo businessman Brandon Maidenwald says the effort is taking a new focus as the landscape changes.
We've gotten through the winter and we've collected about, in my estimation, almost 5,000 signatures. That's kind of where we're at. But I do acknowledge that the deadline is coming in July, and I also acknowledge a couple of other facts. Fact one is that we've heard from the retirements in the Senate, where the Senate margin was only 3 votes. But with the retirements we've already heard, I like our chances to get this thing done the next cycle, given the Senate that I'm hoping we're going to get. That's reality one. Reality two is that with the deadline coming up in July and with the other hot political things going on in the state, our volunteers have scattered over the winter, and getting them back is going to prove challenging because there are other things going on.
Maidenwald says instead of signature gathering for the initiated measure, he will shift his efforts to a run for the State House of Representatives.
Because I think it's time for the next generation to step up and to serve their city and to serve their state. So we need new leaders who can confront problems with a fresh perspective.
Maidenwald will be running alongside incumbent Representative Pamela Anderson for a seat in District 41. The second seat in that district is currently held by House Majority Leader Al Carlson. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. This Friday's Prairie Pulse television show will feature host Barb Gravel and Brent Ekstrom, executive director of the Lewis and Clark Development Group, talking about the group's mission to expand affordable housing and boost economic development in North Dakota. Here's their discussion.
Brent, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me, Barb.
So let's start out by you telling our viewers a little bit about yourself, your background, a little bit about where you grew up.
Sure. I'm born and raised in North Dakota. I actually grew up in Mandan, went to high school there. I graduated from BSC with an associate's degree. Then I went to Minot State and got my bachelor's degree in accounting. And then I, about 10 years later, I went back to UND and I got my master's of business administration. Oh. So right now I've been working in the finance industry. I've been working with Lewis and Clark for a little, going on 17 years now. Prior to that, I did a little bit of stint in commercial banking. I live in Bismarck. I work in Mandan. I have my wife, Lynn, and my son, Caleb, who will be 8 here in a couple of days, and my daughter, Avery, who's 4.
Well, why don't you tell us what the Lewis and Clark Development Group is and what their mission is?
Okay. The Lewis and Clark Development Group is a consortium of actually 3 separate companies. There's the Lewis and Clark Regional Development Council, there's the Lewis and Clark Certified Development Company, and there's the Community Works North Dakota. We're all co-housed and co-staffed, but we all have the same mission and the same thing. Our mission is to provide affordable housing across the state of North Dakota and to promote economic development and commercial expenditure expansions of different businesses, and whether they're expanding or whether they're starting up.
So can you explain a little bit about the economic impact your organization has had in the state over the years?
So we've done over $130, $140 million worth of lending to different, both homeowners, multifamily properties, and businesses throughout the state. So we've created over 3,500 jobs. We've also done about 2,700 units of housing, whether it's rental or whether it's helping somebody purchase a home. And we actually, right now, we actually own 143 housing units for senior affordable housing.
Wow, that's substantial impact. Yeah. Wow, good for you. Now tell me, is affordable housing an issue in North Dakota and elsewhere?
Affordable housing is an issue across the nation, but it's definitely an issue in North Dakota. Between now and 2029, there's going to be 25,000 more units needed for affordable housing in the state of North Dakota. The issue that you're seeing, that we're seeing with that, is that one of the things that we look at from the affordable standpoint is the cost burden. And cost burden basically means that most people should spend 30% of their income on housing, whether that's rental or whether that's owning. Right now, that's about 27% of people in the state of North Dakota are cost burdened, our renters that are cost burdened. That's expected to increase to closer to 35% by 2029. So the trends that are going on is there's a lack of housing, and the percentage of people that are actually challenged to meet those housing needs is definitely going up. So it's a statewide problem. It's something that we address, and that's one of the reasons we're in existence.
Wow. Okay. In your opinion, do you think homes are overvalued right now?
In some areas, they're overvalued. In some areas, they're significantly undervalued. In the rural areas, they're usually significantly undervalued because it's more expensive to build a home in a rural area than it does actually appraise out at. In some of the larger cities, there's a tendency, in good economic times for the housing to be inflated. I don't see it. Like, I don't see a housing bubble like they saw in California or something like that. There's some pockets, I think, across the state that do have some inflation in the housing market. You know, but if it's, 5 or 10% higher, then you're not going to see a big dip in those prices. So there is a little bit of that, but for the most part, we're actually seeing some undervalued stuff in the rural areas.
Now, can you talk a little bit about some of your specific programs, like home and business loans?
Sure. We'll start on the business loan side. We are a gap financing agency, which basically means if a business is going to go into a bank and want to start a business, the bank is going to tell them that you need to have 30% equity down. And then the rest, the bank will finance the 70%. Well, we only require 10%, so then we finance that 20% gap in there. On the housing side, we have a number of programs that we developed. One is it's called the Dream Fund, and what it can do, it's a revolving loan fund that we use to help people purchase homes, help them rehab their homes. It does emergency repairs. It'll do construction bridge loans. And even in cases where it can't be financed by a traditional lender, we can actually do first mortgages with those. We also have a multifamily program called the Dream 2 Fund, which is a revolving loan fund, too, where we can actually do pre-development loans on multifamily properties, like 40-unit properties or 20-unit properties. We can do the pre-development loans on them to help them get started. Or we can do construction loans, and we can even move into the permanent financing, as well as we can participate in some of the development of those, and we have done a couple of those in the past.
Okay. Now, home buying for some is a little bit of a challenge, right? So you have a home buyer education program. Tell me a little bit about that.
We do. We actually partner with the North Dakota Housing Finance Agency and the Village Family Services to provide an online, it's called eHome America. So it's an online course that people can take at their own pace. It's a six-hour course. And what that does is that prepares them for purchasing a home. It gives them the information that they're going to need when they go in to find and finance that home, or if they're interested in purchasing a home, to give them the information that they should be looking for when they're doing that. It does have a cost involved. It is $50 to take the course online, but like I said, it is at your own pace. But however, like in one of our programs that we have, which we call the EP2 program, which is the employee assistance for essential service workers program, we actually pay that $50 for them. It's one of the benefits to the, like I said, to the EP2 program.
Now let's talk a little bit about the oil boom.
Okay.
Or should I say the drop in oil prices?
Sure.
Tell me, do you think that prices on property or homes, especially in Western North Dakota, were lessened?
Yeah, I'm not a realtor, so I'm not an expert on what's going on in that market. I just know what we see in our office coming in there. We haven't seen a huge drop in the actual prices of housing and things like that, because there's still, although that there is, the oil boom was a lot of temporary workers coming in. That's why you saw a lot of hotels and a lot of apartment buildings going up. A lot of the single family homes, they couldn't build those fast enough, so there's still, the population still grew in those areas, so there's still a demand for that housing. What we're seeing actually is we're just seeing less permits and less requests coming in to purchase homes, but I don't think the prices have dropped all that much. Now on the rental side, the rental prices have come down, so that market has softened. So it's softened, but I don't think it hasn't hit like a big valley or anything like that. I think there's still, even in the western part of the state, especially in the oil producing counties, there's still a need for housing, and there's especially a need for affordable housing.
Okay, good to know. So where in the state of North Dakota is housing most needed right now?
It's pretty much a statewide problem. They all can have their own different areas. When you get into the larger cities, the Bismarcks and the Fargos, it's more of looking for that affordable housing. You know, that market from that $170,000 to $200,000 homes, they're just not out there. You get into the rural areas, you still can't build houses and keep them under the appraised value. So there's just a lack of stock out in a lot of the rural areas, the smaller communities, the 1500s, the ones that are vibrant communities. But it takes a lot to get those needed to get those lots developed, and infrastructure is expensive. You can build a house for $170,000, but when you put it on a $70,000 lot, it's no longer affordable, and that's what's happening. So that's kind of where, you know, we're trying to align with the governor's Main Street program to make sure that where that lessens that infrastructure. So we're trying to work with him on that too.
How do you think the property tax increases are going to impact some people in the state?
I think it's going to have a significant impact, especially on those that are already cost-burdened. Like we had talked about, you know, when you're talking 20 to 25% of people in the state are cost-burdened already, and now you increase their property or you take away a property tax reduction on that, it makes them even further cost-burdened. And anybody that's looking to purchase a home now, that price of that home, that the monthly payment on that house goes up, which means they can't afford as much of a house on that. So then you start getting into the quality of the housing issue. So it'll have an impact. There's such a shortage of housing right now that I don't think we'll see a huge impact on it, because there's already pressure, upward pressure on the prices of houses. Mm-hmm. But I think when you get into that affordable range, those ones are the ones that are going to have a lot more issues with it than your people that are making that average or above average wage.
Okay. Can you tell us about some success stories that you know of or people who you've worked with?
Sure. You know, on our business side, I think they're all success stories, mm-hmm. because anything that we're actually getting to the point of funding, we're starting new businesses, we're expanding new businesses. We've done everything from doing $1 million loan to, if you're familiar with Horsch Anderson, which is a big facility out in Mapleton. When they did that, we helped out with an assistance loan. That was through our North Dakota Opportunity Fund, which has 38 cities that they're eligible for that. That was a big project, created a lot of jobs in a small community. But the ones that really get to me and drive what we do is on the community work side, is on the housing side. For instance, we had a lady just this last November. She had to have her roof replaced, and the contractor came in, replaced the roof, and saw something was wrong with the foundation. When he dug out the foundation, the wall caved in.
Oh no!
So she was on a limited income. She was, and she hadn't purchased a house that long ago, so she didn't have equity, so she couldn't get traditional lending. So what we were able to do then is we were able to do an emergency loan within just a couple of days, because it's the middle of November. If you remember November last year, it wasn't that fun.
Right,
So within a couple of days, we were able to get in there, get her the money so they could get it buttoned up, get that wall fixed, so that obviously the house was safe and secure and she wasn't heating the outside world. And so those are always good ones that we have. And we have a portfolio of roofs that we've had to have replaced for people that are on fixed incomes, mm-hmm. and the insurance might cancel their insurance if they don't fix the roof, but they don't have enough money, so we're able to structure those loans, mm-hmm. and to be able to do stuff like that. So,
tell me how your group is funded.
You know, we originally were funded from grants and funds from and contributions from the federal, state, and local governments. But since we started to do our lending, we've actually started to most of our funding now comes from our fees and our interest that we charge. We're actually 85% self-funded right now. But the remainder of our money, our largest funder is NeighborWorks America on the community work side. And then we also get county contributions from the counties in our area, as well as we do get some small grants from the Economic Development Administration on the federal government. But like I said, that's only about 15% of our revenue. 85% of our revenue is actually earned revenue that we get in from doing a good job of revolving our funds that we have.
If people would like more information on the Lewis and Clark Development Group in Mandan, where can they go? How can they contact you?
Well, certainly they go to our website. And that we just upgraded that and changed
okay.
that, so that was a lot easier than it used to be. So that's at www.lcdgroup.org. They can contact us at info@lcdgroup.org, or they can always call us at 701-667-7600.
Thank you for being our guest.
Well, thank you for having me, Barb.
Brent Ekstrom, Executive Director of the Lewis and Clark Development Group, talking with Prairie Pulse host Barb Gravel. You can watch the show this Friday evening on Prairie Public's television service at 7:30 Central. And joining me right now is the Director of Radio for Prairie Public, Bill Thomas. We are here for our short and sweet membership drive, Bill.
It is short. It's only through Saturday morning, and it's sweet because it's sweet to get great support for public broadcasting, and it's really sweet to get chocolate truffles, cocoa truffles, as your thank you gift, which you may do. You're not required to do it, but you may do it if you wish, when you contribute at $10 a month, $120 a year or above. You count on Main Street to be here and deliver intelligent, thoughtful, enlightening conversation, help to enlighten you about complex issues, and therefore we send out cocoa truffles with complex flavors that help you appreciate a different part of life. 800-359-4145 or prairiepublic.org to support this great programming.
And when we start talking about these, membership drives, how do we gain interest? What can we offer our listeners? What kind of incentive? Well, obviously, cocoa truffles is a big one. That's short and sweet. And we also have that Valentine's connection. So we had some fun with our director of radio, Bill, and a song from the Pirates of Penzance.
Are you the very model of the modern sorry Valentine? Your gifts and little sentiments, they never can arrive on time. Well, whether you're a modern lovesick gentleman or lady-o, we surely can assist you with this offer from your radio.
Well, it's not the Major General, but it's the Valentine's Day coming up. It's the right sentiment because we do have these fine cocoa truffles from Nicole's Fine Pastry for those people who come in with at least a $10 a month sustained membership. And that's a pretty reasonable deal. $15 gets you two boxes. $20 gets you three. You can do the math all day long, but the important thing is the math is important to Prairie Public, to what we do. We're very happy that you listen to Main Street, obviously. It's wonderful to have people listening to what we do. We spend time putting this program together. We like to think we're offering a unique service to Prairie Public's listeners, but the important thing is it's validation time. It's time for listeners to become members or members to step up and maybe help us a little more, because this year we are dealing with a tight budget. The state of North Dakota was dealing with a tight budget. They shared their concern with the
yes.
people that they help budget, and we were among those people. So now we're turning to the most important piece of our budget pie, which is you, listeners who are members. That's the most important chunk of support we get, and this is your opportunity to show that support. 1-800-359-4145 or online at prairiepublic.org.
In just a moment, we're back with the usual sort of Main Street thing, and I do want to mention about that little song. We just played a little clip of it, and for your information, either for your attraction or aversion, we'll probably play a little more tomorrow and the whole thing on Friday. So we'll see if we can get it posted on the web as well.
There is a chorus in this.
There is a chorus. There is the official Prairie Public Chorus and Chocolate Society provided the chorus. So when you listen to Prairie Public, you get some silly songs like that, but mostly you get great programming that helps you be informed, better appreciate music and cultural things. Coming up in just a moment, Chuck Laura, who helps us better appreciate the natural world around us. After that, there's Dakota Datebook. There's the news. All those things come with your support when you call 800-359-4145 or go online to prairiepublic.org, and this time of year only, cocoa truffle thank you gifts. So give us a call and help keep the radio going.
Our knowledge helps determine our awareness. For example, a biologist will see things in nature that the rest of us miss. Chuck Lura teaches biology at Dakota College at Botineau, and he shares his love of living plants and animals with us through his Natural North Dakota essays. Today, his subject is river otters.
Some of you may have heard the first river otter trapping season of modern times in North Dakota closed in early December. The season opened back on November 27th and closed on December 4th when the statewide limit of 15 animals had been taken. That's a short season. Most everyone is familiar with beaver and muskrat on North Dakota waters, but I suspect that few among us are aware that there are river otters in the state. Fewer yet have ever seen one. That may soon change. River otters are native to North Dakota, but little is known about their historical abundance and distribution. Vernon Bailey, in his A Biological Survey of North Dakota from 1926, noted that Lewis and Clark mentioned them in their journals. Alexander Henry the Younger also traded for otter skins at his trading post on the Park River in the early 1800s. So the species likely inhabited at least the upper Missouri River and Red River and their tributaries. Bailey also noted that by the late 1800s, otters were observed around Valley City area, assumedly on the Cheyenne River. They were also observed around Devil's Lake and were reported to be common in the Turtle Mountains. Bailey's observations, however, end in 1915, and harvesting river otters was prohibited in 1920. Not much has changed until recently. According to Robert Seabloom's Mammals of North Dakota from 2011, reports of river otter began in the 1960s. Most reports, however, were made in the early 2000s. The North Dakota Game and Fish Department subsequently verified river otters in Grand Forks, Griggs, Nelson, Pembina, Ransom, Steele, Stutzman, Trail, Walsh, and Wells counties. It seemed apparent that the species was making a comeback. Then in 2016, the Game and Fish Department announced that it was considering a limited trapping season on river otter for 2017. So on November 27th, the first limited trapping season for river otter in over 90 years commenced, and it lasted for only 8 days. The river otter is back. With careful management, perhaps the population will continue to increase and expand their range. Then one day soon, we may be able to occasionally watch and enjoy this interesting North Dakota native. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Bottineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Discover the universal appeal of Shakespeare in Africa's newest nation.
There was a plan to build a replica of Shakespeare's globe in Juba in South Sudan.
Celebrate a 5-year trip to every country in Africa.
It's very strange to see a creature that I haven't seen that much in Africa. It's called a tourist.
And explore the pleasures of Normandy on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Tonight at 8 Central here on Prairie Public.
Hi, I'm Main Street's Ashley Thornburg. Have you heard of our short and sweet member drive? It's the one where you support us with your membership investment, and we send truffles.
200 pounds of chocolate.
We need some dessert muscle.
Somebody has to roll them in cocoa powder.
Thankfully, there's the hardworking staff of Nicole's Fine Pastry.
People start coming in at 6 in the morning.
Last year, Nicole's sent out thousands of truffles. Did you get a box? Want one this year? Now's your chance. Go to prairiepublic.org.
Well, it's 5:55 a.m. truffle time.
This is Dakota Daybook for January 31st. One of North Dakota's early legislators was Harv Robinson. Harv came to Sentinel Butte in the spring of 1891 after attending Purdue University of Indiana. For 10 years, he was a cowpuncher along the badlands of North Dakota's western edge. He was mainly with the Three Sevens outfit owned by the Barry Boyce Cattle Company in Billings County. He was known far and wide out west, which led to his election as Billings County Treasurer in 1900. He served one term. Robinson eventually started a cattle operation of his own, growing it into one of the biggest in his neck of the woods. After his term as County Treasurer, he took a position with Interstate Bank of Billings County and soon became its president. 5 years later, he established Stockman State Bank of Medora. He also organized a handful of other banks in eastern Montana. He was married twice and had 3 children with his first wife, Jenny, who died shortly after giving birth in 1908. Robinson was a popular man, and he handily won a seat in the North Dakota House of Representatives in 1910. He served 1 2-year term. Robinson also served as treasurer for the Republican State Central Committee and was elected one of Sentinel Butte's first trustees when the village incorporated in 1913. Local legend tells of Robinson, the banker rancher, winning another rancher's outfit, horses, and everything he owned in the world except his family while shooting craps. Though later on, Robinson loaned the man $20 that he allegedly turned into $50,000. Harv Robinson was born on this date in 1867 in Indiana and died in 1962 in Dickinson. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura. I'm Earl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Just a few minutes left in our Main Street program, but enough time to remind you that we do have a short and sweet membership drive, which is underway until midday Saturday. And if you're a listener and not a member, this is your chance to make that next step. It's important to become a member if you're listening right now. Give us a call, 800-359-4145, or online at prairiepublic.org. We've got some incentives for you.
Oh, yes, we do. It's a special time of year as more and more people have keyed into this new version of an old tradition, and it's our pre-Valentine's drive. And if you pledge at $10 a month or more, we will send out a one-pound box of delicious hand-rolled, freshly made, artisanally caressed by by a loving crew of workers over at Nicole's Fine Pastry, cocoa truffles. We'll send out these wonderful cocoa truffles to you or to wherever you direct us to send them in the continental United States in time for Valentine's Day. And you know what? If you pledge at $20 a month, $240 a year, we'll send out three boxes. It goes up as you increase your pledge. You can send out more boxes. Some people choose to send out quite a few. They send them out to their scattered family members, to business associates, to relatives of all sorts, and it's a wonderful way to recognize Valentine's Day. And all you have to do to get that all happening is make that contribution. Call 800-359-4145 or go online to prairiepublic.org.
That's what Harriet McClellan did in Mandan, and we thank her for her support for Prairie Public, and we hope she enjoys what might be coming her way. At any rate, thanks again, Harriet. You know, we love our listeners here on Main Street because the fact that they listen to us is an affirmation of what we do. But, of course, listeners are consuming the product. Memberships make it possible. So a few times a year we come to you and remind you of that cold, hard fact that this is a business, too. It has a bottom line and it has bills to pay. And we rely on our members to help us make those payments. Give us a call. 1-800-359-4145 or online at prairiepublic.org.
Again, that's 800-359-4145 or prairiepublic.org. You know, one of the things I love about Main Street as a listener is they take us out on all kinds of adventures to show us about what's going on around the state. Sometimes it's hearing students give 3-minute quick summations of their research projects, or it's skydiving, or it's going to an auctioneer's convention, or going to the great largest Scandinavian festival in North America.
The Hustfest.
The Hustfest. So Main Street takes us all around and helps us get that extra attention to our region that we really appreciate. And it is supported by people like you. Couldn't be here without you. Our listener support is our largest part of our income budget. It is absolutely vital. And you, as a listener, making that voluntary support enables us to be here and keep doing this. 800-359-4145, prairiepublic.org.
For those of you who have taken that step, thank you. And that's heartfelt. Thank you for doing that, for becoming a member or upping your membership and supporting Prairie Public, because these are times when we need this support. Our programming costs money. Our people cost money. They're valuable, of course. And it costs money to fire up those transmitters and spread the signal all across the state. And that's where you come in. Members keep Prairie Public vital and on the air. Members help us do what we do every day. And for those of you who have helped us, thank you. Coming up on Main Street on Thursday, beer in the climate crosshairs. It's a report from the Food and Environment Reporting Network, which says that the growing frequency of hot, dry weather and powerful storms is challenging barley farmers. Well, on Thursday, we'll talk with the report's author about how growers and brewers are facing a volatile future as researchers race to develop strains that can better withstand climate change. And, of course, we'll remind you of our short and sweet membership drive. We hope you enjoyed Main Street today, and we look forward to having you with us on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.